So, before tea, I said something about the legend of Shantideva. There's always a legend, it seems, around great teachers, but always within the legend there is some meaning or usefulness in the legend that points to something for practice. And I wonder whether the emphasis on laziness, on the reclusive nature of Shantideva, you know, he was rarely seen around the monastery, pointed to something of the, firstly, that spiritual practice is an individual endeavour, or at least when we're practicing, it's us practicing, it's us as individuals committing to a spiritual life. It will become clear that it's so important to have a Sangha, a spiritual community around us. But at the same time, it's our individual commitment that we're making. And it seems from the sense of recluseship that Shantideva might have, at least by legend, demonstrated, there was an intense personal commitment to the practice and study of the Dharma. Perhaps that's what that's communicating. I wonder also whether the emphasis on laziness is significant as well. I wonder whether it's about the amount of time one needs to step away from the worldly life in order for spiritual practice to be ultimately effective. And it's emphasising the need to step out of worldly concerns. We can be very busy in our world, we can even be very busy in our spiritual lives, but it can also get in the way. We can be very good at and very productive and very generous, and we can ignore the things that we need to do to deepen and broaden spiritual practice. In fact, we can also feel guilty about not working hard enough to help. So I'm wondering somewhere whether there might be a pointing to a stopping that's required sometimes. This is just my fantasies about it anyway. I don't know that there's any commentary that draws out the legend, but maybe there's always something meaningful for practice in a legend that it's pointing to something meaningful, useful. So the Bodhicharya Vitara, this is it. This is one translation of it. There are many translations. And by way of introduction, we are using an abridged version in the readings that we'll be using each week, mainly to point to the essential principles and guides for practice that are contained within the larger text. The larger text is a remarkably devotional piece of work. It's full of really challenging ideas and practices, and it's very demanding to read. And I think the fact that it's very demanding to read points to life, the spiritual life, actually being very demanding. Very demanding of a really good, hard, clear look at ourselves, but at the same time that the practice of spiritual life is not easy. That there are really demanding principles, really inspirational principles, of which there are, in a sense, no end to their cultivation. And you really get a sense of how deeply moved and mysterious these principles are from reading the Bodhicharya Vitara. The essential structure of what we'll be doing over the next few weeks is centered around the practice of the paramitas, or the perfections, or that a bodhisattva, a being that's training and guiding people towards enlightenment, bodhisattva practices the paramitas. This week we're particularly looking at introducing the series, but in the subsequent weeks we'll be covering generosity, dana, sila, ethics, they're always there, shanti, you could say, it has a number of connotations, but it's patience, forbearance and forgiveness are the three particular qualities that go with it. Then virya, energy in the pursuit of the good, Samadhi, or concentration, meditation you could say, and pranya, wisdom. And finally, dedication of merits. In the practice of the spiritual life, one holds nothing back for oneself. One always dedicates one's merits to the benefit of all beings. And that's particularly something that arose within the Mahayana practice, the practice for the benefit of all beings. So, and finally, as we go through the weeks, you may recognize that some of the phrases we repeat regularly. And it's from the Bodhicharya Vitara that our puja comes. So the puja or devotional practice, the ritual that we do on retreats and sometimes at this class. And as we go through the readings, you'll hear excerpts from the puja just suddenly arise. And it's a bit strange, actually, because we think it's a complete work in itself, but it's actually phrases that were particularly pertinent, that were taken out of the Bodhicharya Vitara, which in a way capture the spirit of a spiritual aspiration, a spiritual journey. So we could say on these 8 weeks we're on a spiritual journey, an spiritual exploration. So let's come to this week's text. I read the text before the tea break, and I just thought we'd just take a verse at a time and see where we get to. So in the first verse, Shantideva writes, reverently bowing to the Buddhas, to the Dharma, and to the noble sons and daughters of the Sugatas, I shall briefly explain the practice of the Buddha's disciples according to the scriptures. So he starts with reverence and bowing. And I wondered, well, what do we think about bowing? What's the purpose of it? Why does he start there? Just before we say that, just as to rectify terms a bit, Sugatas is another word for Buddha, for the Buddha, and it particularly draws out the immaculate and blissfulness of the enlightened state. So Sugata is another word used for an enlightened being. So you become a son of the Sugata through practicing the Bodhicharya Vitara. So what do we think about bowing?
Does it imply that when you're bowing you're showing gratitude, and when you express gratitude you're sort of becoming more receptive and curious and sort of ready to absorb something?
Yes. So it seems to connotate this quality of receptivity and gratitude. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Anything else? Does anybody resist bowing?
Yes.
You're nodding to Ella.
Because I'm the best person in the world. So, you know, it feels just to clarify. I think sometimes I feel a lot of resistance to bowing to something which I don't really understand, and it feels a bit forced. And something that I wouldn't do to anybody else or anything else.
And how does that feel? That sense of resistance.
It feels like a struggle inside of me, because on the one hand I'm quite captivated by a lot of the ideals, but on the other hand it feels really counterintuitive.
I think it's mixed, isn't it, for most of us. I certainly, it was for me at the start, I wasn't quite sure what I was bowing to or why I was bowing. I think there's something that evolves in terms of a recognition of meaning and mystery. Certainly something that I've felt that I wanted to recognize value, that I gained, benefits that I gained from meeting the Dharma. And eventually it became quite a natural thing to bow whenever I came into the shrine room. But it wasn't straightforward, and it in a sense it needs to develop in our own time. It's not required. In a certain sense, and we mustn't see it as a requirement, but it's something, I think, of an expression of receptivity, an expression of wonder, a response to wonder and mystery of the Dharma, and the Buddha as the ideal that embodies that. And something more about how I want to express commitment to those values, express commitment to the ideals. But I wanted to start there because we do it every time we come in. We rarely have a discussion, at least beyond introductory level, about bowing. And Shantideva starts there. Mainly, I think, because to cultivate this sense of receptivity, we're sort of showing receptivity ready for a teaching in a certain way. And I think that's perhaps why he starts there, quite rightly. Yeah.
I think in different countries and different groups of people, they tend to bow to each other. I bow to my next door neighbour's wife. Although she understands English, right. If her husband's there, their husband, if her husband's there, she won't communicate with me. And she'll kind of smile and bow, and I always put my hands up and bow to her as well. Because she recently joined one of their festivals, brought me a couple of meals round, you see. And I knew because some of the children were with her, she wasn't going to say anything because, you know, they have realised that their mother's been talking to me, and obviously they are fairly strict to my next door, basically. Get on very well with them. And so I tend very often, and she would do the same to me.
I think, so it can be a natural way of showing respect. It's a natural way of being. Acknowledging and respecting others.
Especially in India as well at that time, 800 AD or...
Yes.
And Japan as well.
And if it's not... if it's not natural for us, perhaps we can see it as a practice. A practice of undermining egotism. Sometimes our resistance can come from this sense of me... not wanting to be less than or me being the centre of my world. And that's okay. You know, we have to be where we are with it. But perhaps we can see it as a practice of, and we can experiment and take on trust that there's benefit, or we can simply explore the experience as we continue to bow as a practice. But it's something we're deciding to do. We're not doing it because, and we're doing it because we're interested in the experience and to uncover our responses, rather than to because it's what people do. Yeah. Maybe that's enough on that for now. Okay. Okay. So the next verse. This precious opportunity, with the leisure and other conditions needed to practice the Dharma, is extremely rare. This is what makes life meaningful. If we waste it now, when will it come again? So, what do we think he means by the precious opportunity? That we're human. Can you say more?
Well, according to traditional Buddhist understanding, it's a rare and precious thing to be reborn as a human, and it's through an accumulation of meritorious acts in past lives, and the human body is the vehicle to enlightenment, so you better use it or lose it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's the primary thing, being human, having human capacities and qualities, and having the potential that exists inherently within being a human being, yes. Are there any other things that make up a precious opportunity?
To be brought to the teachings.
Yeah. To have the Dharma available to us, yes. And in addition to that, in a way that we understand, in a way that we can accept.
I mean, just working on that, do you think he's also referring to sort of all those circumstances which make it possible
that
the people can be together
as
a group to understand these teachings, to have the time, the space, time in their lives?
Yeah.
Which, I guess, shouldn't be taken for granted.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really something that we actually do have some leisure time, at least in this world. I mean, there are places in the world where people do not have leisure time and are working continuously and don't have the means or the availability of resources or retreats or simply time where they're not working just to eke out an existence. And in that way, I mean, there may be some of us here who actually are in those conditions because of the circumstances of our lives, but still we can get to this class. And in a sense, it's quite humbling to reflect on that opportunity that we have, that we are in the conditions of the West where we have leisure, where we can spend time coming to a Buddhist centre, coming to a class, even giving some time to meditation. It's worth reflecting on that those opportunities don't exist elsewhere in the world, even today. Even for some people in London, in the UK, those conditions may not exist. So what a precious opportunity we have.
There's political freedom as well.
Yes. There are some places in the world where to practice Buddhism would put one in prison. And so we feel very fortunate that there are the conditions and the society that allows people to follow their faith. Yeah. Yes, and there are perhaps a couple of other things as well. Not having views that prevent us from meeting the Dharma, or at least being open to the Dharma. Our conditioning is such that we are able to be open to the ideas that are presented in the Dharma. We're not so strongly conditioned into a particular way of being or views that make it impossible for us to hear the ideas of the Dharma or the principles of the Dharma. So, yes. Is there anything more on that?
I sort of took it to me, not just the small as coming into awareness and being present. So we really are present, so even for a split second you are in your present experience, that itself.
Yeah.
A precious opportunity to develop and cultivate that it's, short or long time spans, that is.
Yes, I think you can see it that way too. Okay, so let's move on a little bit more. Like a flash of lightning on a black stormy night that gives one instant of clarity, so by the power of the Buddha, the worldly mind is sometimes lit up for a moment by skillful intentions, but the power of the good is weak, while the power of darkness is strong. If it were not for the bodhicitta, what could conquer this darkness? So this is the first time in the text where the bodhicitta is mentioned. So what do we understand by I'm sure there are people who understand the term bodhicitta. So we have bodhi, which means enlightenment or awakening, and citta, the heart or the mind. It's the one word for the two places. Heart-mind is the best translation of citta. And often it's translated as the thought of enlightenment, but Bhante has been very clear, Sangharacha has been very clear, that it is not simply a mental event. It is, in heart-mind, there is an emotional dimension. There's a volitional dimension. So he's translated it as the will to enlightenment. So this sense of our beings moving towards, our whole beings, not just as an intellectual exercise, but a movement in our whole being towards enlightenment. So we're going to come back to that a little bit more fully in terms of how that's cultivated next week. But in terms of that paragraph, is the power of good really weak? And is the darkness so strong? So what do you think he means by the power of good? Or what does he mean by darkness?
I heard another sutra one other time where they talk about how just so few people ever really in the world if you really sort of wake up to the Dharma, and that it's actually really rare and not many people actually ever really do it. Sort of made me think of anyway. Mm. It's actually very few people that actually can, that can sort of have a vision and sort of advent life, whatever it is, whatever it takes to sort of follow that through.
So there is this piece where it's sort of the flash of lightning on a stormy night, sort of that moment of clarity that we can have, which sees things clearly, which responds to deeper meaning, which has seen something of value, where we've responded fully, we've resonated with it. Perhaps we've seen something a bit more clearly, we've understood something in terms of what brings most meaning into our lives. And maybe on retreat, or maybe it's a life event where we start to see, actually, what is my life about? What really, what do I want to orientate my life towards? And it can only, it may only be a moment. It may only be a moment, but it has tremendous significance for us. But over time, that can fade. That can start to disappear. And the significance that we wanted to follow up and that brought us into more meaning can fade as well. So there's something about the ability to keep following up that meaning, or at least take that meaning and explore it more fully, that moment of clarity that we sometimes have about what gives our life most meaning. So there's that piece about it. And then along with that, there's the sense of the capacities to keep following that up. So it might be that we recognise that we want to be vegetarian. And we see the clear suffering of animals, we see the clear, we have a very strong response to it. But we're in conditions where we're surrounded by meat eaters, that there's a very strong peer pressure to continue eating meat. In fact, we might even enjoy it. And so that moment of clarity over time, we lose sensitivity to through the conditions that we're in. So you might also see it as an ethical sensitivity, the strength of the good. Although Sabhadramati would say it's not about being good. it's that sense of refinement and response to principles that are ethical qualities. The moving away from harm and the moving towards love. The moving away from thinking for oneself only and the moving into generosity. And the movement from indulging in sensual pleasures and the movement into stillness, simplicity and contentment. The ethical precepts are familiar to most of us, but our ability to follow them through consistently needs to be trained. It's very easy for us to, speak for myself, pick up a glass of wine and think that my mindfulness can be maintained with a couple of glasses of wine inside me. But it's so easy to keep on picking up and refilling, isn't it? And then suddenly we haven't got our mindfulness anymore. So perhaps it's something about our ethical awareness that needs to be cultivated. And when he's talking about the power of good, maybe he's starting with that ethical awareness that needs to be trained, developed, refined, the practice of and development of the training principles, the ethical training principles. Does that make sense? Does everybody have another interpretation? Yeah.
I was just going to say the terminology of good and evil is used in that particular way. It's used in a very generic sense, isn't it? It's sort of a quite very broad brush.
Yeah.
And I wonder if part of that is in a way a challenge to make us think, well, what do we really feel about that? What do we really understand about that? Do we really understand it? Does it really mean something? Because obviously they're very powerful terms, but in the way they're used, it's sort of, you know, it's a dramatic night, it's a flash of lightning, you know, which we're familiar to from so many films, I suppose. But in that way, I wonder if it's a challenge to sort of reconsider what, in the context of the more sort of mediated texts, the mediated teachings, what do those terms really mean?
Do you have a sense of that? What those terms would mean for you?
It's almost like this is the beginning of the text. It's asking a question that is not going to be answered straight away.
Yes.
So it's sort of opening up a bigger question, which I would then expect to be sort of led down a very long route if you start to eliminate it. But maybe it's useful in that context.
So we have a dramatic start. And a question posed of what is the truly good?
This might be really for both people that you've said, but something that came into mind was just something like, well, good intentions will never be enough. Like, I was thinking of just in all our ordinary relationships, like romantic relationships and with children, with parents, and that most of us kind of don't set out to make a mess of them, but we often do. You know, we often, there's a sort of tragedy if you don't set out thinking, I'm going to really hurt this person, or that somehow or other, something about even with the best intention we do, which I do find tragic, you know, in my own life, and yeah, you see other people's lives, and then to, they say that there's going to have to be something else that comes in, with something like with the best will in the world.
Yes.
We can't seem to avoid that. There's sort of forces within us that seem to, you know, you do that thing. I remember when I was a little girl, I used to think, I'm not going to argue with my mom, I'm not going to argue with my mom, I'll just be arguing with her.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing with the best will in the world, you can't. But, well, this Bodhicitta, which we haven't really fully explored, there's something else will need to be in place for us not to just succumb to fall on the first hurdle or something.
It might be
kind of both already said.
And so this notion of that it's not going to be by will alone.
Yeah, that's it.
That we overcome our limitations. So what do we make of the notion of darkness that Shantideva's stating here?
I take it as a kind of invitation to look at your own mind, and you don't usually think of our mind as dark. There's a lot of things we think are very acceptable. Feeling like something, you're annoyed by something, or just general small feelings of ill will, greed. So the invitation is to maybe look and see, is that dark? Is that actually dark? Is there something, a lighter that you can move towards? So these habitual ways that our mind moves, we probably wouldn't like to think of them as a dark place, but actually there may be a skillful action that could really illuminate that.
Yeah. I wonder also whether we can think about it as, well, we can be inspired in a time, in a particular context, and then when we come back into our regular conditions, that starts to fade, and our, you know, and we need to be aware not only of what inspires us, but what limits us. A sort of frank appreciation of where our own particular limitations, our own, as you say, habits are, you know, what most limits us, what are our particular habits that get in the way of us coming into real relationship with our spiritual aspirations. What is that for us? Because it will be different for each of us individually. So it's just perhaps a question we need to pose for ourselves, that Shantideva was inviting us to consider. And at the same time, to emphasise that not to underestimate our craving, our delusion, our greed, our the things, our aversion, that it goes deep. It does go deep, even though we have a sense of ourselves being generally helpful and positive in the world. We shouldn't underestimate how habitual we can be, how we can create the conditions for our own limitation. So he's encouraging us to frankly appreciate the breadth of ourselves, our heights and our depths, whilst not becoming too worried or not becoming too judgmental of ourselves in that pursuit of appreciating the breadth, the heights and the depths of ourselves.
Sort of
feels a bit like
he's actually telling
off
the monk for being cynical about
it
as well.
Yeah, maybe.
The lightning metaphor works quite well with what you said. You know, there's lots of depths, and they're very murky, and they're all over the place. But every so often you have this beautiful flash, and it's small, but it's very different, kind of startlingly different to the masses of murk that are everywhere else. So that's a reason to be hopeful, even though it's tiny. It's just clearly so different and so much more beautiful than everything else.
Yeah. And so much of the spiritual life, you could say, is cultivating and looking after the condition for more and more of those flashes to arise, really looking after and cultivating the conditions where those senses and sources of inspiration are more and more present in our lives, the things that we really respond to and the things that help us stay with the inspiration and clarity that we get in those moments.
Can I just ask that? It sounds as if, to me, that he's made a mistake by saying that the forces of good are weaker than the powers of darkness, or however he's telling it, because that is surely suggesting that when you are, you know, craving and our negative mental states are stronger than love and generosity and kindness and openness and all of that stuff, and surely the opposite is true.
In potential, I think what's being pointed to is our capacity for selfing is tremendous. Our capacity for being self-oriented is remarkable. But our potential for love, generosity, is also immense. The question is, which do we choose? How do we create the conditions What conditions are they that bring those qualities more and more to the fore? Sometimes I like to think of the positive emotions as immensely subtle. At least we sort of sit in a field of them, but we get distracted by smaller, apparently more potent states, more limited states that give us a real sense of strength and potency and identity. So you could see perhaps that in moving into those positive qualities, we're moving out and opening up into those positive qualities. But it's our identification with ourselves and the protection of that self that limits. And so in saying that the forces of darkness are strong, our capacity perhaps for selfing, for identifying with ourselves and for seeing ourselves as the most important individual in existence, our capacity is strong for that, and it can be limiting and distracting. And so in moving into subtlety and refinement, we move into those more positive qualities, and they only become strong through moving into them and inhabiting them more. In a sense, we're moving out into those qualities. I think perhaps just a metaphor for that. I don't know, is that any clearer?
I wonder if the metaphor of the dark night and the lightning supports that, because the lightning, the same, where does it come from? It seems to come out of, almost out of nowhere. The dark is kind of the background, and this lightning is where does skillful action come from? Sometimes you don't quite know where the good comes from.
That's what I think in the video. It seems like a bit of a challenge. It was saying, it's a good thing to speak evil strong. So you really gotta have to work hard. It's quite easy to have the sort of negative thoughts. You really have to work hard to move yourself into, the other place. So it seemed quite challenging. It's like, this is the natural state of the world.
Yeah.
If you want to outside that boundary, it's
really
hard to.
Well, there are so many conditions in the world that work against spiritual practice, that work against generosity, love, and my awareness, mindfulness. So many things that distract us. In a sense, distraction is one of the main limiting factors. We can have a very full life, and it we can fill it up with so much distraction that we don't really ever have a full sense of ourselves. In terms of looking at the sort of darker forces, maybe materialism, maybe consumerism, maybe those types of forces in the world as well. Not just the forces within ourselves.
Sort of part of the metaphor is that darkness, we don't, if you think about darkness, this kind of darkness, I don't think it's quite the same as a dark night entirely. And the way I see it is, as a darkness, and you don't realise it's darkness, because it hasn't been illuminated. So it's only dark in the sense that you're not aware of it. And the flash of illumination suddenly brings an awareness of something which otherwise you wouldn't have realised was darkness.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have realised was, I suppose, absence or something not good.
I think that's absolutely right. I think you can see it that way. Absolutely.
I think there's a sense of certainty you think you can get from a sense of self, that sort of gives you grounding in the world, and to move into subtlety and refinement sends you into murky and charted waters.
It
can be a bit scary.
Absolutely.
Sometimes the forces of darkness, that it's not as cut and dry as good and bad, and light and dark, that they give us security and consistency and stuff and what we're looking for in the world, and to move beyond it is big and scary.
Yeah.
Sometimes distracting ourselves with full lives can, sort of buffer, the scariness and. Yeah.
I think you're right. I think if any of us take on the spiritual life in earnest, we're always moving into and exploring new and uncharted territory, and certainly where we're starting to come up against our limitations, our views, and we're starting to perhaps see through them into we don't know quite what. It's absolutely certain that fear will come along. Fear will be present. And a learning to live with a sense of uncertainty in life is an enormous part of it. So yes, absolutely. In a way, it's in those moments that breakthroughs really can happen. And it says, well, we can just learn to be in a larger, more unknown, less limited perspective, one that's less self-oriented. We can experience fear, but if we can sit with it, we come into a completely different relationship to life entirely. But it's that learning to live with and learning to sit with that's crucial as we see through habits and limitations. And in a sense, we create ourselves in a different way, or we keep, at least for a time, and then we're uncreating ourselves or seeing through self entirely. So... gosh, time's really batting along. So let's come to the bodhicitta, because really, if we go away with one thing this week, I think it should be that, the sense of a sense of the bodhicitta. So we have this thought, we don't have a thought of enlightenment, we have a will to enlightenment. And you can see it as the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. So it's the thing that arises in those moments where we feel connected with all life, connected with beings, connected with their concerns and difficulties, connected with their potential, and the sense of wonder at the potential of human life. It arises in the independence on a seeing through of self. It's the dimension of experience. If you see, for example, we've talked previously about stream entry, and Shantideva talks of fetters that limit us, that hold us in conditioned existence, and particularly the fetters of where we first start to break through our limited views of self, the views of ourselves that limit us, are the notion of self-view. The fact that I'm a fixed and permanent, unchanging self. We sort of see through that actually there's, in reality, nothing fixed or permanent about this thing I call self. In fact, it might even be an illusion itself. Yes? So we see through that. In independence on that, we develop confidence, and we have confidence in a path. Confidence that spirit, the Dharma works, and we have orientated ourselves so fully with the training principles or precepts that they are naturally, spontaneously alive in us. Okay, And it's those are the first three fetters of self-view, of doubt, and of ethical observances as ends in themselves, which are broken at the point of entry into the stream. So this is, you could say, the point of insight, the point of seeing through self. And the bodhicitta is seen as the altruistic dimension of that experience. It's the part of that experience that's not about you. In a sense, it can't be your bodhicitta. It's the experience of something working through you that's pulling you out, sometimes even against your will, even against your better judgment, to meet and help others, to come into relationship with others, to see how interconnected human lives are, in another way, it can't be something that you experience on your own. In a way, it requires other people to be present. It's more likely to arise in the context of a community of people practicing, where there's somebody to be generous to. There's somebody to be... in a sense, there's that flow of generosity and kindness and awareness amongst people in a spiritual community. The bodhicitta, as it were, the will to enlightenment, the altruistic dimension, is only going to arise in relationship to others. In a sense, it's something that flows through you, that puts you in service of others. A sense of really wanting to help, assist, to serve others in the world, particularly maybe people who you're practicing with. If it is the bodhicitta, it's effortless, it's natural, it's spontaneous, that sense of just meeting the need that's immediately there, and one would feel compelled or moved to just meet whatever need is there. I wonder if I could say anything more about it. It's difficult to actually express the notion of the bodhicitta. It is we did a series here on the suprapersonal force. This notion of when you let go of egotism, something comes to work in its place. Something comes through that has a quality of energy. It has a quality that's moving one outwards, that's opening up into the concerns and a concern for welfare of others, that's natural and spontaneous, that in a sense one can't hold or grasp or say it's mine in any way. In a way, to say it's mine is not it. To say it's my bodhicitta is not the bodhicitta at all. It's not the will to enlightenment at all. So, does that make any sense? but that's sort of what it is. It's as if that's what it is. you could say one is in the process of the deep resonance and concern and working for the welfare of others. And this isn't, I think it's probably say to round up, this isn't new. This isn't a thing that the Mahayana dreamt up. This is historical Buddhism. In a way, the Buddha always, well, the Buddha did talk about teaching for the welfare and the benefit of many, working for the welfare and the benefit of many. And when he's talking about that, he's talking about the bodhicitta at work in the world. In the sense, the purpose of practicing the Dharma is for the welfare and the benefit of many, for the arising of the bodhicitta. So you have this collective will towards enlightenment, where everybody's striving towards enlightenment, seeing what's needed for each other, each other person in that community, and meeting it, and moving into that relationship and resonance with each other. This is a very beautiful thing, a very beautiful ideal. So maybe that's enough for this week. And next week we'll come back to the bodhicitta and perhaps cultivating the bodhicitta. That's enough.